The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2019 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2019. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and the ACCS at classicalchristian.org.
I have a confession to make. I had one job to do, and getting ready for the conference, I had one job, which was proofread my outline when Tom Spencer sent it back to me. And because I failed to do my one job, you have extra work to do. I'm so sorry. So this was actually last year's outline. It was a great outline. I loved that workshop. But Tom asked, would I please present a workshop on memory that has never been presented before, something for people who are first-timers in the movement, who know nothing about classical Christian methodology. Would you please introduce them to the methodology of memory? And I said, sure. You know, I did that talk a year ago. No, I don't want you to do anything you've done before. So nonetheless, I failed to proofread the outline when he sent it to me. My bad. And so now you have extra work to do. So I hope that you have a handy-dandy pen or pencil that you got for free in your goodie bag. Please take it out. I want you to write six words. So on pages 124 and 125, you will find last year's outline. The good news is that you do not need page 125 because I made a very broad outline. So you just ignore all the text on page 125. And we're just going to put six words on page 124. And you get to determine how much space you want to put between those words. But this is your basic outline. So the first word is memory. Give a little space. Then the next word is frame. Give a little space. And there are two words which are big picture. Give a little space. And then write the word tools. And then write the Latin word caveat, which means warning, beware. Those are your six words. Does anyone need me to repeat those six words? You have done well. Well, we're starting off really well. I've made you move, I've made you write, and now I'm going to ask the Lord to be with us so that we can have an excellent workshop. Father, we thank you for the opportunity to train up the next generation. I thank you for the teachers who are in this room and the schools that they represent. Father, would you grow them as teachers? Would you strengthen the work and improve the work of their hands? Would you help them to grow as artisans? And Lord, would you add to the number of each of their schools? Grow this movement, Lord. Make yourself known and bring up the next generation to glorify you. We pray in your name. Amen. My name is Leslie Collins. I'm the head of school at Covenant Academy. We are a sweet little space in Houston, Texas, and it is a joy and privilege for me to talk to you here this morning. For those of you coming in, I'm so glad you're here. I feel disconnected from you over there on the right side, so if you could move over on this side, it'll make me very happy because I really enjoy getting to know my audience, and I really look intently at your faces to see how what I'm saying is received, and it helps me to know what else needs to be said. So when you have a cranky face, I figure I need to convince you, and when you have a happy face, I figure you've got it. So you could make this workshop really short if you just smile the whole time and say, okay, good, God bless you, have a great day. So I'd like to talk a little bit about what causes us to remember. What is memory? How do we remember? Physiologists will tell you that memories are formed when neurons make new connections and synapses in the brain, that they reside in the hippocampus portion of the brain and then eventually move back into the cortex. But we are more than neurons and synapses and hippocampus and cortex. We are embodied souls. So it is important for us to remember that in our body, our brain is firing off and making connections and filing that information. But but our soul is intricately connected to that process. Daniel Siegel has done a tremendous amount of work in understanding the brain, and it's fascinating because he believes and has researched to show that essentially the work of the brain is through relationship, that it is our relationships that set us up to remember. And of course, anyone who has been around children and understood the development of children, particularly in the area of adoption or in the area of understanding children who have been abused, you understand that children who do not have a nurturing relationship from the time they are born, their brains are permanently altered, and any work that we're doing is trying to reform. And thankfully, the Lord our God has made our brains in such a way that there is neuroplasticity. The brain is always making new. So we can always be learning. That is the gift of the way God has made us. We are more than a brain. We are embodied souls. The words of God from the psalmist. The psalmist says, "I remember the days of old. I meditate on all that you have done. I ponder the work of your hands. I stretch out my hands to you. My soul thirsts for you like a parched land." The work of meditation, the work of pondering, the work of stretching out and understanding that we thirst for God, that is a work of remembering. And as we do these things in front of our students, and as we lead them in the act of remembering and pondering and meditating, we are forming in them memories that will last for eternity. What a blessing that is. It's so much more important than cram and pass and forget, which is in so many schools the ideology and the machinery of how they move from one lesson to the next. That's not where we want to be. So let's talk about how we remember. God calls us to remember the frame. He says, "I remember your frame. I know that you are but dust. I know how I made you." And because God says, "Remember the frame," we must remember the frame of our students. We must know what they're capable of. We must know their developmental process. We must know who God has made them to be and how they grow up. And Piaget is not the person that we're looking to. Look and watch and study children. The ideology that comes from the world that says we're blank slates, and that's all that it is, and all of our understanding of morals is based on what the world has taught us, that's ideology that we can say far from. But watch children and understand how their language develops and understand the way in which God has made them. He is the God of words. If I were to ask you in this audience, I bet you could do this from memory. If I were to ask you, what is our chief end? You would say, man's chief end is to, and to, our chief end is to glorify God and to enjoy him forever. Now, I don't know if you are aware of this, but the little ones that you teach are terrified by that idea. My chief end is to glorify God. What does that mean? Does that mean that if I'm in math class and I think math is really awesome, is that glorifying God? Because I'm pretty sure that glorify God means that I'm supposed to stop and pray. I'm pretty sure that worship means that I'm supposed to be praying or singing. But you see, worship is worth-ship. It is doing things that are worth it. And when you show children their worth as image bearers, their worth as learners, well, then they understand that worship is not only singing and praying, which indeed are worshipful activities, but worship is learning a new formula in math. Worship is learning a new idea and concept in science. Worship is learning how to write a paragraph. Why? Because our chief end is to glorify God. And let us remember, we are made in his image. Imago Dei. We are made in the image of God. We are made in the image of the one who is the Word. Words are so powerful. We are made in the image of the one who gave us five senses. He did not give us three. He didn't give us two. He didn't give us one. He gave us five. And so, the way in which we teach should be according to the frame in which we are made. Our students should experience all of those senses in our lessons. If you think that the way to teach is to control the child and make them sit in their desk and make them attend to you with their eyes only, then you're missing out on the whole frame of the child. By the way, I do think that it's important for children to control their bodies because we're called to take dominion, including over our bodies. But so many times teachers miss out. We are made in the image of the one who is truth and goodness and beauty. So as we reach for these transcendental values, we are finding out more of who he is and who we are. We are made in the image of the one in whom we become more like him and fully human at the same time. This morning, as we heard from that incredible rhetoric student, what a blessing Charity was to us in sharing with us what it means to be fully human. As we are fully human, giving ourselves away, we are reflecting the Father himself who gave himself away. And when we imitate him, we lose not ourselves, but we become more of who we were meant to be. This is the ideal of what we are seeking. And it doesn't matter if you have a pre-K class or a sixth grade class or a 12th grade class. We are seeking to help our students become more fully human. Every year in the summer, I fill my patio with plants. I have this one-piece lily that my mother-in-law was tending to, and it was her pride and joy. And it was enormous and needed to be potted, repotted, because it was pot-bound. So I had to take my little trowel, and I had to stab it, and I had to divide it, and then I had to put it into different pots. Of course, I had to approve the color because it all had to match. And then I had to get more potting soil, and I had to beat those roots that were pot-bound and separate them and apologize to them for causing them pain, but it was going to be for their good. I might have really done it now. And then I put them into pots, and I add soil, and I watch them thrive, because Houston is a great hothouse. So my patio is flourishing in the summer. And then it gets really hot, and they don't do so well. Super, super hot. And I begin to have to bring them in. As the season turns into the fall, they continue to thrive in the home. But then winter comes and spring comes. Well, spring for us is 70 degrees. Probably for some of you, we used to live on the East Coast. Spring in Maryland was still really cold. But for us, it's wonderful. What happens to those wonderful peace lily plants that are thriving in the summer, and now I have six or eight of them, which was all one. What happens to those plants is, as they're brought into this environment that they're not intended to be in, my home. I love my home. My plants weren't designed to be in my home. When I bring them in, they start to burn the leaves. They start to get yellow on the edges, and that yellow turns to brown, and they just lose their luster. And I wonder, what's happening to this plant? And then I take it outside because it's 70 degrees again, and I begin to watch the plant change. It's such an incredible thing to watch. Because leaves, the very same leaf that was brown and yellow and losing its luster, the very same leaf, I can watch the chlorophyll fill all the way up and begin to be working its magic as the plant becomes green again and the leaves become shiny and it is flourishing. Now, in your classrooms, we desire human beings who are flourishing. That plant is a plant. It doesn't matter if I move it outside or inside, it's still a plant. But is it flourishing? What causes our students to flourish? Well, that is when we teach them how to worship all day long. That is when we teach them how God has made them, that He has made them, that He has made in His image, and that because they are made in His image, they are able. I will ask my students, who made you? God. And God has made you, and they say, able. You are able to do whatever He's asked you to do today. So let's get to it. Have a great day. We are most happy when we are learning, because God has made us. We are made in His image. That means that originally Adam and Eve were dependent on God, and it was good. They were to depend on God for knowledge and education. They received their education from Him. He told them what to do. Be fruitful and multiply. Take dominion. All this I've given to you, go ahead, take it and make it better. I can't wait to see what you'll do. Go ahead. He gave them the directive of what to do, and He gave them what not to do. That was their education. So mankind is designed to be dependent and interdependent on one another. We're not designed to be independent of one another. We are designed to work together. So when we are learning, because we are designed to always be learning, when we're learning new things, it is as if that green is coming up and we begin to see we are flourishing. When we are creating and when we are loving others, loving learning, loving God, that is when we are flourishing. When my mother died this spring, it was very tragic for me. My mom, I hope that she changed her mind at the end, but until her dying days was an ardent atheist and did not want a funeral, thought they were useless, they meant nothing, life means nothing, goodbye. That was incredibly painful for me for so many reasons, which I'm sure you can understand. And so for me as a daughter and as a mother, that is an experience I had never encountered. What is life on a planet without a mother? That is really pretty powerful to go through. And how can I mourn? I don't have the normal way of mourning. I knew that I needed something. There were two things that I needed, and it was spring. I needed to do what I was called to do as a human being. I needed to get myself into a story, and I needed to get myself into creation. And I needed to create something. And by doing those three things, I was able to get past my mourning and to process that in a way that allowed me to get from being dried up and shriveled and sad to able to take the next step forward. So I listened to Till We Have Faces for an entire 24-hour period. It was a phenomenal experience. As I was recreating my patio, it was spring, and so I was bringing all of those plants out and redoing all of that in my patio and bringing all of that to life and creating beauty wherever I could, because that filled my soul and made me feel whole again in a way that I couldn't in any other way since the opportunity to mourn in the traditional way was not given to me. So I share that because I think so many times in our classrooms, we forget what is it that nourishes our soul. It's stories. It's stories. Classical education is about being part of the great story, the meta-narrative. God has made the world has fallen, He has redeemed it, and now we're waiting to see it come to fruition. So becoming part of a story for your students is a helpful way for them to understand their part as a character in that story, in the setting on which we call planet Earth. and giving them an opportunity to create. Whether it's tending to a garden for your classroom, which I heartily endorse, whether it's creating art as you're teaching, whether it's doodling and sharing their doodles with the class, whether it's creating stories and writing, whatever it is, your children were created to be part of a story, to be storytellers, and to be creating and sharing truth and goodness and beauty with one another. And I don't want you to lose that. I'd like you to, as we're moving on, the big picture. These are the two words, big picture. I want you to remember the big picture of the trivium. Now, as I was thinking about what kind of an image to give to you to serve as a metaphor for what I am going to say, I thought, oh, I'll just find three columns and I'll just go ahead and take a picture of a picture of the ancient ruins, and that'll represent the trivium. And I did. Actually, when we went to Italy and we were there in the Roman Forum, my daughter had a picture and had beautiful sunlight on it, and I thought, I'll do this. And then I started thinking, wait a minute, when we have pictures of ancient ruins and I have three columns that were part of a larger building, am I saying that this is what's going to happen if you are part of classical education, that it's going to be an ancient ruin? I thought, no, I don't want to do that. So I moved away from that, and I thought, well, this is fun. I'll use the three columns that are from the ancient Greeks. So we have the Doric, Ionic, and Corinthian, and they just so happen to come in the order of the larger number of syllables, the newer they are. That's very helpful as a memory tool for me. But I really just want to emphasize right now the Doric. It is the most masculine. It is the most, it is known to be the strongest. And it is the first and the oldest. And I will use it as a representation for grammar. Now, in your work that you are doing in your classrooms, I want you to remember that you are part of a three-part system that is actually part of a seven-part system of the liberal arts. In our classical schools, we primarily focus on the trivium. The trivium is a language arts curriculum. Wait a minute, what are you saying? Are you saying that we don't do STEM? No, I'm saying that grammar, logic, and rhetoric are about knowing the art of words in which we describe everything we learn. Have you noticed that history is not one of the liberal arts? It's not, because the grammar and the logic and the rhetoric are what we use to describe everything. History is part of the words and the vocabulary that we develop. Mathematics is, of course, one of the liberal arts that are in the quadrivium, but nonetheless, we focus on the trivium. Giving our students words. Vocabulary is what helps them to communicate and understand what you're saying. And vocabulary, as we remember what makes our brains work, is very intricately connected to relationship. So as you have a strong and solid relationship with your students, bringing them through experiences and explanations, as you love them well and love the subject that you're teaching, they will love what you love because you love them. So, grammar, logic, and rhetoric. In the grammar, in the foundation, we have that Doric column. Do you see the drums that are stacked on one another, those lines in the column? Raise your hand if you see those lines. Those are drums that are stacked together. Now, I've only seen it once, but when I've been to the Parthenon, you can see the hole inside. And I believe, and I'm not an architect, but I believe that they were held together by a boss, which I think is pretty cool. And I would say that that boss is, of course, the teacher, and that the drums are the way in which you teach, the words, the chants, the memories that you are building. You might call them subjects, but of course, Dorothy Sayers would say it's really all one, and so we don't want to look at them as distinct subjects, and so I believe Dorothy is right in that respect. But nonetheless, let's look at that Doric column as an opportunity for us to envision what we're doing. Now, the Doric column is the one that you would see in the oldest buildings. It is the strongest, and it would be the one at the front of the building because that was where they believed the greatest amount of weight could be contained, which is why grammar school is the foundation on the logic and the rhetoric. They can't do anything without you. Grammar school teachers often feel like we're less than. We're not as smart as those logic and rhetoric teachers because those people know big multi-syllable words. And we're just here in grammar school. But they can do nothing without you. You are the foundation. So what I would encourage you to do is remember who you are. You are so important to the fullness of the trivium. And they will build on what you do. So build carefully. Be intentional about what you ask your students to commit to memory. I will talk to you in a minute about how to help them commit things to memory so that it is effortless, and it should be effortless. There should be no tears involved. It doesn't need to be that way. But as you work as a team together, you as grammar school teachers, please put aside this notion of inferiority. That's from the devil. Take with you that God has called you, and he has therefore qualified you to partner with your upper school teachers to say, what do you need your kids to know? Rather than, which I see happen, but I taught them, but they knew that, but I promise I told them that, but you see, this is really important. Just ask them, what do you need them to know? Because I will teach it. Whatever you need them to know, whatever that foundation is, I will give that to you. Ask them. It was very helpful for me when I was teaching third grade. I asked one of my colleagues in the upper school, what do you need them to know? Well, I need them to understand these essentials of the Greek culture. Got it. I need them to understand the essentials of mythology. I need them to be able to interact with that. I need them to love it. I need them to love it. Got it. I can do that. Very helpful. What a blessing for me to see those little ones graduate this year. Students that I taught in third grade going to Athens and seeing what we had talked about and the tug of war that we had between Athens and Sparta when I was trying to get them excited about learning and they thought this was so cool and knowing that now they've been. What a joy that was for me. So you want to make sure that as the drums are intentionally placed in the memory of the column, you want to intentionally place everything you will teach your students. You want to find out what is needed and put that into place as a grammar school teacher. Remember that you must be strategically building skills and vocabulary that they can take with them. Do not limit yourself to your scope and sequence and say, okay, I know my scope and sequence. Great, I've got it. Oh, I just have to do my scope and sequence and then I'll be okay. No. That's the least of what you have to do. Yes, teach the scope and sequence. Teach what you need to teach, but see yourself as part of a larger framework, a larger team. Your goal is to build Velcro in your students so that as words fly at them, they can catch it. There are so many students today who are lacking the vocabulary, lacking the understanding of all the words that are flying at them in the classical resources that we use, that it's getting lost. So your job is to give them Velcro so that when those words fly, they stick. Actually, it's their parents' job, but since you stand in their parents' place for 6 or 7 hours of the school day, it's your job for the school day. Critical to us seeing our students love learning is our relationship. Now, I will talk about relationships toward the end. I want to get into the nuts and bolts of memory work in a moment, but I want you to know that that's a half of what I want to talk about today. Because unfortunately, when we as teachers become control freaks, become stressed out and anxious and angry that our students aren't doing what we're asking, we often unintentionally create an environment that is very stressful and not life-giving. And the reality is that the brain, when it is stressed out, does not learn. It survives. And kids are figuring out how to survive all day long with a stressed-out teacher whom they're convinced hates them. And the stressed-out teacher has no idea. She's just freaked out and worried that she won't be able to teach her scope and sequence if these kids don't get it together. So I'd like to help you avoid some of those traps, because all of the work that you're doing with memory won't stick. Because that Velcro that we talked about requires a heart that's ready to hear. And that heart that's ready to hear requires a relationship. So I want to talk about that after I deal with the nuts and bolts. So let's talk about the tools in the toolbox. Now, what I picked this picture because it's flourishing. It's not industrial. It's not hammers and nails and rulers and all this industrial equipment that makes you feel like this is what we're doing. We're putting people in boxes and we're nailing and doing all this grunt labor. No, we're actually just cultivating. We're actually just letting things grow. And we're actually looking for ways to prevent plants from being pot-bound and plants from being scorched by the wrong kinds of temperature and the wrong kinds of atmosphere. We're actually just looking for ways to cultivate truth and goodness and beauty and a love for those in their lives. We want to cultivate their affections. And so when I say tools in the toolbox, don't hear industrial things that we must do to box kids in. Please hear, these are ways that you can train their affections and shape their love for learning. So I'd like to talk to you about them. There are four basic tools in the toolbox that I think all go together in memory. And there aren't just four, but there are four that I'm going to talk about. The first is chance, and I will talk a lot about them. So I'm saying it first so that you know I'm about to talk more about it. Chance, not C-H-A-N-C-E, as in, oops, I don't know, that just happened by chance. I mean chance, as in amo, amas, amat. That is how our brain works. Pop-ups, rhymes, and songs. Now, Dorothy Sayers talks a lot about these in her article. She says that children love that thunder. They love the movement. They love the noise. They love the rhyming. They just love it. They like noise. And they like singing. Children like to talk, and they like words, and they just can't get enough of them. You know why? Because God has made their brains to be so. God has made their brains to be all about words. They are just gasping for more words. Can I have more words? Can I have more words? And if you ever spend time with children, you know that they can't have more words. They just get them, and then they tell you them all the time. Does this sound familiar to you? They can't stop. And you should not stop. You should just turn on the faucet and let it flow. Let them have words. Let them learn words in songs. Let them learn words in rhyme. Let them learn words in various things that you do that create fun and exciting, memorable experiences and explanations for them. Give them access to words. One of the challenges, though, is that we have to give them words and also a framework with a Christian worldview. Because she also warns us, words, and yet they don't know how to think. So we need to make sure we teach them how to think. The desire is to cultivate in all of this a love for learning more. So we want them to be constantly seeing what we're doing and connecting and considering it a launching point for further discovery. And by the way, you actually don't have to control everything they learn. You can let them go. They can learn things without you because your job is just give them a little boost and let them do the rest. Get out of their way and let them learn. So I want to talk about chants in particular, songs I think you all get. Pop-ups are a little bit different. That's a segue of chants, and I'll explain that in a minute. And rhymes. Poetry is different than rhymes. Of course, the fun little lyrical things where teachers are just playing around with words. I like to be punny with words. I like to come up with little catchy phrases, and let's make sure that kids don't think that that is poetry. Poetry is deep and resides within the soul, and that is a beautiful expression. Your children should be memorizing lots of poems, and you should be reading poetry to them, and you should be reading in such a way as they can't wait for you to read again. I listened to a teacher yesterday tell me that she has made a tradition in her classroom that every time it rains, she turns off the lights, they sit on the carpet, and then it's literature time. And so now when it rains, they can't wait to have literature time. And she has captured that for them and cultivated with them an affection for for loving literature. What a joy that is. So give them those moments. So let's talk about chance. One of the things, the first thing that I'd like you to understand is that it's an opportunity for you to front load that information. There are some people that say, well, that's so counterintuitive to me. I thought that we were supposed to teach in this classical way with Socratic dialogue so that they would come to their conclusions. Because isn't that the way Socrates taught? Socrates never taught eight-year-olds. He assumed they had this. That was part of the paideia. Don't come to my class not knowing this basic stuff. This is basic stuff. Yes, you want them to come to some conclusions, and you do need to have some wisdom and discernment as to which thing do I let them discover. But the reality is that you are the mother bird. You are the bird who goes out and finds the food that your babies need. I don't care how old your babies are, they're your babies. You go out and find that food, you gather it up, and you give it back to them. You front load that information because they don't know how to find the food. That's your job. And so with a chant or with a pop-up, I'll explain, you are front-loading that information so that you can begin a conversation with your students. So that is a value of chants when you write them. You are doing the work of study, and you get to be the eternal student. What a joy! Because as teachers, we're the kids who never left the classroom, right? And so you love learning or you wouldn't be here, right? And so they give you a topic, amphibians. Amphibians and reptiles. I think I'll discover everything I can about reptiles and amphibians. What do I need to know? Then you gather all that information up and you make a chant. It actually doesn't have to be awesome. Kids will think it's awesome if you let them move their bodies. There's the trick. So you're front-loading information. You're providing a context for connection. So as the children are connecting and making connections with the things that you're reading, so you have a chant. It is your bread and butter meal for the day. You make the chant. That's part of how you introduce the lesson. You figure out everything, at least a starting point for information. Of course, you can't teach them everything about reptiles and amphibians. You're probably not that smart, and neither are they. So I know I'm not that smart. So you give them the basics of what you need to get started. And then you go to your library, either your school library or your classroom or your public library, and you get as many books on reptiles and amphibians that don't contradict your worldview and freak you out, and you bring them in and you put them in your classroom, and they go, wow, they talk about biomes. We talk about biomes. And there are certain reptiles that can only live in certain... I know. It's crazy. It's like this world is all to be discovered. They're making connections. That's your job. You are like a travel agent. And your job is to say, well, you could go here, and you could go here, and you could go here. That's your job. So it provides context. It also provides structure. What a joy it is. We are going to start science. Everybody take out your science folders, and let us begin our reptile and amphibian chant. And then they begin their reptile. Actually, when I taught it, it was a pop-up. You're still wondering. How many of you are wondering now, what is a pop-up? I know, I've got you shocked. I'm going to hold that for a while. No, I'll tell you. So I did an actual reptile and amphibian pop-up. I taught them all the facts that I wanted them to know. I had 28 students. So guess how many facts I picked? 28. And so what I would do is I would assign student number one, because it's very helpful to have student numbers because it makes life orderly and easy. Does everybody know that? Great. You know, mailboxes. It's a beautiful thing. So student number one knew that he or she was doing fact number one, and they would pop up. Can you pretend you're student number one and pop up for me? Yeah, you. Yeah, pop up and say fact number one. Just say fact. There, didn't she do a great job? Well done. And then, Mark, you're going to be student number two. Go ahead and stand up. Student number two, and say fact number two. Thank you, Mark. What a great job. Okay, so that's how it goes. Did you see her pop up and sit down? Did you see him pop up and sit down? And she has a fact, and he has a fact, and if you have, let's say, I hope you don't have 28 kids. I hope you have 12. At which point they would get how many facts? They would get two each because you don't want them to just have one. And guess what happens when she's absent? He knows her fact. Because guess what happens to these amazing children? They are so good at memorizing, without even applying any effort, they know everybody's lines. Guess what I'm going to assess them on when I give a quiz or test? The pop-up. Guess how hard it's going to be? Effortless, unless they don't know how to spell, which might make life difficult. Do you see? Now, has she learned a fact? Am I giving them information? Is this going to provide a connecting point? So we start science class and we bring out our reptile amphibian pop-up. Science class has started, but it's only just begun because we've done a pop-up, and yet we're only getting started with what does everything mean in that pop-up? What does her fact mean? What does his fact mean? How do I define these terms? How do I connect them to other places? How do I show them the history? How do I show them the geography? How do I pull all of this together? What an exciting opportunity it is. The other thing that they provide, chance provide an opportunity to train students to focus. You will have students who don't want to participate. Now, a pop-up means somebody has a responsibility. It's one fact, it's theirs, you have one job to do. Of course, we want them to have more than one job, so if it's just 12 facts, we want it to be 24. But you have one job, and you need to do that well. So they're going to be focused on that. How many of you think students are going to be paying attention when they know the whole class is listening to them? How many of you think they're going to be paying attention to that? Yeah. But let's say you have one whole chant, similar to the prayers that we pray in the morning before we get started. Now imagine you said that prayer or something like that every day. After a while, do you think some kids are going to coast? They're going to start just sliding on while everybody else murmurs, and they're just kind of murmuring, and everyone else is giving their full voice. How many of you have seen that happen? Okay. And so when you are helping them to understand that actually this thing that we're doing right now, this recitation of a chant, this is not busy work. This is memory work. And so I'm walking through all of my desks to make sure that you are actually focused. I can't hear you. I'm getting down close to them because I can't hear them. Because inevitably, the kids who are focused, they've got their folder out. They are going through. They are listening. They are attentive. They know everybody's line. They know what the whole class is doing. They're invested. They do well. They may be an average kid, but because you're providing for them above average methodology, they are doing well. Then you've got this really smart kid, and they're just, this is so easy. I'm just not even involved. They're not attentive. They're not paying attention. You can't hear them. And lo and behold, when you ask them questions, they can't answer because they're not invested. So it trains them to focus if you make them focus. And it helps them to learn what to focus on and how to be attentive. And that's a really important discipline in training their affections. It also trains them to follow. So the challenge of this really bright kid, which often happens, is they're so used to being able to catch that vocabulary very quickly because their brain has a strong capacity often for vocabulary. They're not used to actually having to work hard. They don't really follow well so many times. But you know, and I know, that the best leaders are followers first. First you follow, then you lead. So one of the things that is really helpful to do is to teach leadership. So my next one is that it also trains students how to lead. So let me explain. If you have your class all sing a chant together, perhaps it's a song, perhaps it starts off with one word. You have one student every day and you go through a rotation. Or perhaps it's unpredictable, they never know who you're going to pick. And you say, Sally, please lead our chant for science. Sally, please lead our chant for history. Sally, please start us off. Sally starts off, guess what everyone else has to do? Follow Sally. Sally learns how to lead. Everyone else learns how to follow. But next class period, I might be really unpredictable and not have Sally do it and make Robbie do it. And now Robbie's going to lead and everyone else has to follow. Sally and Robbie are learning that sometimes they are leading and sometimes they're not. And everyone else is learning, wow, this leadership thing is really hard. I hope they follow me. If I say this word, everyone's going to hear me. And boy, for a fifth or sixth grader, this is like a big deal. If I say this word, they're going to hear my voice. And maybe they won't like the way I sound. And I'm going to say it anyway because my teacher just asked me to. And everyone else is going to follow. And then everyone does. And oh my goodness, we're learning together. Wow, this is so cool. So you've empowered and equipped these young men and women to understand what leadership is. You've given them lines in a script, which is what your chants and songs and rhymes and pop-ups are. You've given them lines to perform. And if any of you have been in a drama, you know that the actors on the stage, when they really embrace those lines and really understand the role, they're transformed by the opportunity to act this out. Well, that's what is happening in your classroom all the time. So chants and pop-ups give us the opportunity to learn to lead and to follow, and they also cultivate wonder and awe. Now, you should not think, please do not think, that all you do is memorize the chant. You just say the chant, and then we move on. So here's what I don't want you to do. Please don't say the chant together. Let's say it's a history chant, and everyone is doing something, some one piece of information that they're all reciting together. And then, of course, because this would be very valuable, if you have one piece of information that's valuable together, that might be more of a worldview or a cultivating the affections. Maybe that's a prayer. Maybe that's something that they've memorized that you really need them to know is one body. And then you might have a pop-up. You should always have history pop-ups that are involving your timeline that, as Dorothy Sayers says, involve images, evoke memory, because they're seeing, as you're saying the date, as you're saying the name of the person, they're seeing an image, which, how many of you are familiar with Veritas Press, their cards? Excellent. And Story of the World also has cards. How many of you are familiar with Story of the World? Okay, how many of you are not familiar with any of that? Okay, well, one of the beautiful things is this thing called PowerPoint, and some of you may be totally against this. I don't want to offend you. But if you have the opportunity to have a PowerPoint, I was able to grab images from this thing called the internet that makes it really easy to say, I want to know something, I want to see Helmut from the Bronze Age, because my students are going to tell me when the Bronze Age and when the Iron Age and when the Golden Age, did you catch that? When all these occurred, and so when they see Bronze Age, they're going to see a bronze helmet, and it's going to tell them the dates. And so they're going to have this permanently embedded with the sight and with the sound and with the banging of the desk, and I've involved three different senses, and so that's more likely to stick, right? In any case, the history lesson begins. You're chanting something, you're doing a pop-up, then you open up the textbook and begin reading, go to the back, answer the questions, everybody fills out the worksheet, and today, boys and girls, we have had history class. Close the book, end of lesson, next subject. Don't do that. You have your communal recitation, something that is evoking a worldview implication that you want to convey to them, something they must understand. Then you have a pop-up in which they are popping up and they are seeing images and they're banging on their desks and they're clapping and they're having a blast and it makes sense and it takes a laborious, in the beginning of year, 7 to 9, maybe 10 minutes to get through that exhausting pop-up with all that information, and you sweat through it, and you tell yourself, it's worth it, it's worth it, it's worth it, it's going to pay off, it's going to pay off, it's going to pay off. And you do that every day. And then, from the beginning to the end, because of course your pop-up is in chronological order, from the beginning to the end, you begin to unfold that pop-up and say, so you remember this date? Let me tell you the story. Do you remember this image right here on our PowerPoint as we're popping through? Remember this one? Let me tell you the story of that. Read this chapter. Let me tell you this story. Let me show you this artifact. Let me tell you about how it was discovered. Let me tell you how it connects with math. Let me tell you how it connects with theology. Let me tell you how it connects with science. This is so cool, you guys. I can't wait. Week after week after week, you're moving through this pop-up which shockingly is about the same number of weeks as your school year. It's funny, like you get to control that or something. And then at the end, after day after day after day, that pop-up is not just a bunch of information. That's a story. You've invited them to be part of a story. And they know the characters. They know the behind-the-scenes information. They see the way it's connected, and they're excited. So they get to the end of that story, and they can whip it all off. We used to say we'd do 7,000 years in 7 minutes. And they're so excited when they can do it. And when somebody's absent, they can take their part because their memories are so strong. And then, if you want to assess them, it comes from that pop-up. I could ask them a question. Tell me when this was. Well, that was in. Tell me about this. Well, that was. Tell me about this date. And where did that occur? That was the Battle of Salamis, and that took place here, and it was so bloody. Yeah. And that was when everything turned. Yeah. But you see, that was effortless. It wasn't painstaking. I didn't take it from a book that somebody else did all the work for. Open it up, throw it on the copier, give it to the kids. Thank you very much. Here's your grade. That's a transaction. We're about transformation. That's our goal. And that's what chants do. See my time here? Okay. So, let me look at a chant with you. Now I've given you some background of the value of this. This was a chant that I did, and I'm going to ask that you participate. So this is something that the entire class would do. This is not a pop-up. Oh, by the way, you can find this on the Member Resource Center. So let me show you. If you need chants, there are plenty of them. There's a storehouse for you. I can't see how big that is, but I hope it's big enough for you to see. How many of you familiar that are with the Member Resource Center through ACCS? So if you are a member school, then your school has a membership code. You go into the Member Resource Center, pop in your little ID and your login information, and you have this storehouse of chants and songs and memory devices that will help you think of great ways to communicate. I happen to really enjoy writing them, but you may not be that kind of person. You might really need somebody else to write it for you so that you can modify it, but it always has to come from you. That's the first law of teaching. It has to come from you. So let's say you need a chant. Go to the Member Resource Center. Start there. You don't have to reinvent the wheel. That's the beauty. There are so many resources for you there. So I encourage you to go there and use that. But let me back up. Here is the History of Israel chant, which is on the website. You can find this there. So I'd like to ask you to participate with me so that you can understand. I personally believe that loud and thunderous teaching is very effective. I think kids like being loud and that we should encourage it. I think there are times when we should encourage children to be quiet, but that is not the time in which we are teaching the most effectively. That is a time when we're teaching them to listen. Ultimately, though, it's very fun for them. So, do you see the dashes, the double dashes? If you were in my classroom and you were sitting in ready position, I would expect you to bang on your desk. It's actually a lot easier because you're sitting right here and your desk is right there. You're not usually allowed to bang on your desk. So when I give you permission to be naughty, it makes me fun to follow, which makes it easier when I have to be hard on you. Get it? So if you were in my classroom, you'd be in ready position and you'd be banging on your desk. But today, you're not in ready position and you're not at a desk, so you'll just clap. So the double lines mean clap, clap. And the second set of double lines is clap, clap, too. So I will show you the first line, and then you will follow me, and we will go all the way through it. I have till 10 after, correct? You'll tell me in a sec. Okay, so the patriarchs, 2200 to 1700 B.C. Let's do all of that together. The patriarchs, 2200 to 1700 B.C., slavery in Egypt, 1700 to 1453 B.C., Exodus, 1453 B.C., Judges, 1413 to 1020 B.C., the United Kingdom, 1051 to 931 BC. Solomon's Temple, 960 BC. Divided Kingdom, 930 BC. Babylonian Exile, 605 to 535 BC. Assyrian Exile, 722 to 720 BC. Return and Rebuilding, 536 to 415 BC. Conquering, Alexander the Great, 332 BC. Roman Rule, 63 BC. Jesus Christ, in 3 AD. It was so fun to learn that Jesus was actually born in 3 AD and not 0. That was fun for me. I had to do a little discovery. Now, by the way, I'm not a historian, and I might have gotten some of those dates wrong, but I got some basic areas of time areas in which they could slot into their brain. My goal was that if they're reading and they hear something said, it happened in 953 BC, they say, oh, well, that's kind of before Solomon's temple was built. That's pretty cool. The goal is that they have mile markers on their journey. 15? I have 6 minutes. God bless. Well, that was fun. The goal is that these would be mile markers for their journey, and that in these mile markers, they would be able to contain information on which they could hang. This is a skeletal infrastructure. Okay. I told you where to go for the chants. I want to help you understand how all of this puts together. So the infrastructure of your chants, of your effortless memory work, is that it provides the context for the experiences of stories that you connect them with, stories that you tell, stories that you expose them to. How many of you are familiar with Jim Weiss? He is, if you've heard the story of the world on CD or in audio recording, that is the voice that you're hearing. He is an amazing storyteller. You should have him come to your school. It will change the way your children receive stories. He's phenomenal. Jim Weiss is a wonderful storyteller, and he loves to tell stories of history and science and mathematics, so you should find out more about him and other storytellers who can connect your kids to stories. The chants provide activities, or the infrastructure on which the activities that you do make sense. If all I did was introduce a unit on Greece with a tug of war between Athens and Sparta, and I wore my toga, and they wore their toga, and we decided who was going to win, I might have stacked it so that Sparta won sometimes and Athens won sometimes. But if all I did was have that experience, that really wouldn't be educational. It would be fun, a nice party idea, but it actually wouldn't have taught anything if they didn't have the infrastructure of the chant on which to hang it. So they provide that for you. Field trips are incredibly important, and you should be a frequent flyer at your museums. Your docents should know who you are. They should see your school coming and say, ah, now those are students I want to meet. It's a bit of a prideful thing, but it was always my goal that when I took my students on a field trip, that the docent would say, these are the most well-informed children I've ever seen. Thank you very much. That was my goal. I would encourage you to allow them to experience that. I also encourage you to find plays that they can perform for your families. There are many, many, many historical plays on the internet that you can find. Some of them are not worth reading. Some of them are. But you see, if you've got the infrastructure there for the chants and the songs that you're doing that allow for the memory to be relatively effortless, then as they begin to perform a play, they begin to understand what it was like to be Julius Caesar and to be stabbed by his friends and to die on the stage as their parents cast simultaneously on Facebook. And various projects that you will assign so that learning becomes a lifelong adventure for them. That is your goal, to be the travel agent on a journey. So my caveat for you is please remember that you're just one hill on a very long journey. Everything doesn't hang on you. My warning to you also is, if you are having your students tell you that they're stressed out and freaked out about Friday's test in history, then I would say to you, I think you might be doing something wrong. Now, I don't mean to say that students should not experience difficulty. They should write for you. They should write so much that tears are streaming from their eyes because it's so hard. Okay, not really tears streaming from their eyes. But they should write, and it should be hard, and you should be pushing them. But memory? That's the easiest thing for kids. They can't help but memorize. And so if they're stressed out because they have to cram for a test that's happening on Friday, then you're missing it. You should be assessing them on all of these chants and songs and pop-ups that become part of the structure of your lesson. So it's effortless. It's easy. It comes naturally to them. You ask, and they give you the answer. Not because you haven't told them the deeper magic underneath, but because you've rehearsed it so many times. It just comes. So one of my warnings is, if you are finding that your students are saying that they're freaked out or their parents are freaked out about your test, please evaluate the way in which and what you are teaching. And if it comes from a book that you're taking off a shelf that somebody else wrote, don't use it. Give them a project. Give them another way to assess. Ask them to write essays as much as they are able, whatever it is. But don't make it something else that somebody else has done for you. That's not classical education. And always inspect what you expect. You want your students to pay attention to your chants. You want them to be attentive. I used to tell my children, of course, this was when I was in Hawaii and they completely understood me. Do I have like 2 minutes? One. When I was in Hawaii, they completely understood the difference between paddling and surfing. So paddling, everybody had an oar in. They were on a team and everybody had a job to do so they could get from here to there in the fastest time available. Surfing means that I am coasting on the work of the wave. So those students who are chanting in your classrooms, who aren't actually doing the work, they're murmuring when everyone else is talking and reciting, those students are surfing. I mean, there's some skill involved in surfing, but that's not what we're about. We're a community. Oars in, everybody. We're paddling, not surfing. So because I have to inspect what I expect, I will walk through my rows and lovingly make sure that my students know, I can't hear you. I can't hear you. And if I see them surfing, I might say, there's some surfing going on. I need all oars in. Let's go, everybody. Paddles in. Now, it's important that as I do that, I am loving my students well. I'm building a relationship with them of trust. Because if all I am is focusing on controlling them and managing their behavior and making sure that they're compliant with me and making sure that they're giving me the voice that I want and the answers that I want, and I don't have a relationship with them, well then, as Josh McDowell says, they're going to rebel. Because rules without relationship equal rebellion. So as I'm inspecting my rows of soldiers, because I'm fun to follow, I'm making sure that in an appropriate way, I am touching every student. That was always my goal. As I'm going through, every student will receive from me a touch on the shoulder, a pat on the back, a stroke on the head, because I love you. I am inspecting because I expect the best of you, and I have a relationship with you. So today, when I have to say a hard thing gently, I'm making eye contact with you. I'm entering into your world. I'm giving you a voice. I'm listening. I'm giving you boundaries, because that's what our Heavenly Father does. I'm developing a relationship with you so that you can go on a journey. Thank you for being part of this journey today. God bless you. Have a wonderful day.